I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. I'll bet at some time in your life you had a temp job or worked part-time or was an adjunct, a day laborer, a consultant, a freelancer, a contractor by choice, or because you had no choice. Maybe that's how you work today in the so-called gig economy. Our guest, Lewis Hyman, says that in the last 10 years, most of the new jobs, a whopping 94%, have appeared outside of traditional employment. He writes that the roots of that change began in the 1950s, and he traces the forces and decisions that have led to the current employment landscape in his new book, Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. While having flexibility and autonomy clearly has its benefits, losing actual benefits like health care and not having a predictable schedule and a steady paycheck has its risks. Lewis Hyman is associate professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University, and he joins us from the studios of WGBH. Lewis Hyman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Do we know the size of the temporary workforce in America today?
It is a very controversial question if you are a sociologist of labor or an economist, because it depends on how you define that. If you want to talk about people who drive for Uber or other kinds of digital platforms, it's less than 1%. You know, there's a few million temp workers at any one time, although the number through the year is enormous. But if you include people who work outside of traditional work arrangements, outside of that 9-to-5, you get upwards of, you know, about 30 to 40% of Americans in a given year participate in this freelance or gig economy.
Well, let's go back. And I thought the history is pretty interesting because I think we tend to think of the gig economy as something that happened within the last 10 years. You trace it back to a guy named Elmer Winter, who was the founder of Manpower. What was his thinking behind his company?
Yeah, Elmer Winter was the founder of Manpower Incorporated, and he was a lawyer after World War II, and one day he needed a secretary at the last minute to type up some notes, and he realized that the problem he had was really an opportunity, that actually other business people would have the same kind of challenge finding emergency help. And so he started Manpower Incorporated, and it blossomed very quickly into a national franchise. And in the next 10 years after that, he goes from, you know, just being a lawyer to running this enormous company that serves most of the major corporations in America, supplying emergency labor.
Well, and one can't help but note that it's called Manpower and largely employed women.
It would be almost impossible
exactly.
Not to notice that. Yeah, yeah. That it starts with women, but it's called Manpower. Yeah.
But you say that he sort of, especially in the 1950s, he knew how to sell this idea that a woman should be at home, but she could also have a job. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, it's a really interesting paradox, right? So coming out of the Great Depression, coming out of the war, Americans really wanted security. And you can see it at all levels. You can see it in the business leaders. You can see it in the workers. But the security was not for everybody. It was constrained to defending that male breadwinner wage, especially the white male breadwinner wage. And so the access to security that women had was based on this idea that they should be married. Women were paid less as they are now. And so convincing husbands and convincing women that they ought to or could even work outside the home was kind of an uphill battle. But he did it by saying this is not – he framed it so that the income that they were having was not in any way contesting that sort of male breadwinner authority. And so he frames a lot of this work as supplementary, extra money for, you know, pin money and luxuries and things like that. Same way people talk about supplementary income through Uber today, which, you know, isn't actually always the case. And it wasn't even then.
Well, I do want to get to Uber today, but there's such an interesting history between then and now. What you say is that in the early days of Manpower and appealing to companies to hire some of these temporary employees, largely women, that companies didn't necessarily or didn't bite right off the bat. How come?
Well, it's so fascinating, right? Because we are told that the reason why Uber and all the like are successful today is you can press a button and it's instantaneous, and nothing like that had ever happened before. And actually, in 1960, you could pick up your phone and you could call Manpower And that afternoon, you could replace not just your secretarial pool, you could also replace all the line workers in your factory, as well as the foreman and some of the managers, which happened sometimes.
Right.
It happened when factories shut down and the owners wanted everyone to go on vacation together. It's hard to conceive of that. But it didn't happen very often. And it didn't happen very often, even though it was cheaper to employ temps. It was cheaper to, it was easy to do so. And it was because of the sort of values that business leaders had at the time, this belief in job security, this belief in long-term investment in the workforce, the idea that people actually aren't interchangeable. And they saw turnover and change as things to be avoided rather than something to be embraced. And I think most importantly, they felt like they were defending America, that they, you know, it was American steel that had beat the Nazis, and it was these good jobs that had really ended several decades of several terrible decades of economic uncertainty. And people wanted to embrace this new post-war world.
And you're talking about the Depression and obviously after World War II. So both employers and employees felt this sense of wanting some kind of security, stability because of what they had been through?
Yeah, it was a collective experience. Now, that wasn't a natural outcome. It was hard won, both from workers who began to organize industrial unions in the 1930s and 40s. And reluctantly, some business leaders accepted it, but it became normal by around 1950. And by 1950, you can start to see that, you know, corporate leaders and union leaders and government and, government policymakers were embracing this kind of security. And almost by the end of the 1960s, it had become normal that to believe that capitalism would continue to grow at this breakneck pace and it would provide the good life for the American worker. And unfortunately, since that moment, it hasn't done that quite as much.
Well, let me just belabor the point a little bit more. I mean, were these the good old days? It's easy to put on those rose-colored glasses and look back at that time. And even based on what you just said there, to think, oh my goodness, this moment when capitalism had a heart.
It is very easy to get nostalgic for the post-war, but it's kind of a selective nostalgia, right? So we hear in the media all the time about how we're going to bring back the manufacturing economy and that's going to bring back good old American values. Well, these jobs were only good because of the unions and the laws and the social norms and the expectations of how a company was valued. You know, for 100 years before World War II, manufacturing was not seen as a great job. It was a place where you went to get exploited by a robber baron and lose an arm, right? So this was something that was made, and the nostalgia we have is pretty selective. It leaves out those unions. It leaves out labor law. It leaves out a 93% marginal tax rate for those making over what is today the equivalent of $2 million a year. And it also leaves out Jim Crow and sexism and, you know, migrant workers. And the imagination we have is a good life for some people that was hard won.
Some people meaning white men?
Some people meaning white men. That white men had access to the security, and people who were left out of that world, you know, women, people of color, migrants, you know, they had lives that were just as insecure as all of our lives are now. And in a lot of ways, their exclusion from that security is what allowed our contemporary insecure economy to grow. By the fact they were left out, they became a rehearsal. Their work lives became a rehearsal for what was to come after 1970.
Was there a psychological price for that kind of security and loyalty?
For those people that
were benefiting from this kind of work economy. And I guess I'm thinking of, in fact, you're right about the kind of conformity that might have gone along with some of these jobs.
Yeah, this is also so, and now I understand what you're talking about. Yeah, in the book, I write a lot about the trade-off between security and autonomy, right? So in the post-war, yeah, we got steady paychecks, but we also had to, you know, put on that, you know, gray flannel suit and sit in the office. We had to stand in front of an assembly line and turn a wrench for 8 or 10 hours a day. And, you know, to my mind, the American dream, the American goal is not just to have security, but to have autonomy and self-direction. And a lot of the book is about this sort of, you know, tension within the post-war and the period after it, about how, you know, how do we return to an America where we have both security and autonomy at the same time?
Something changed, though, as going from the 50s into the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, something that changed that changed this relationship between the employer and the worker and also gave rise to this temporary work. What was it?
So in the book, I detail this question about how corporations should be organized. You know, we think of the corporation, like many things in the economy, as something that is ahistorical. It has always been thus. It has always been a certain way. And I show how the modern corporation arose starting in the 1920s, but then how it also began to fall apart in the late 1960s through a financial craze called the conglomerate craze of the 1960s that many people have not heard of because few people were adults and observing, reading the business pages in the 60s. But it was crucial because what happens in the 1960s is you get this wild buildup in corporations that are buying unrelated companies, and they fall apart beginning in 1969. And in the aftermath of that, there is a wholesale crisis among business leaders. How should we run our corporations? What should we do? What is the future of capitalism? And the group of people I argue in the book that really transform this understanding of how corporations should be run are this new cadre of management consultants and business gurus who are selling a certain vision of how the corporation should be organized. And that vision treats economic security for investors and workers and managers as a problem to be solved rather than a virtue to be celebrated. And we see the birth of the new lean corporation.
And we also see we're almost up in a break here, the importance of the stock market to companies, to corporations.
Absolutely. So through the 1960s, this binging on diversification and conglomeration was fueled by the stock market and things that, you know, many people think happened in the 1980s, like the leveraged buyout or mergers and acquisitions. They were all over the place in the 1960s. And it is the way in which we value those companies that begins to change in the 1970s. So it becomes more valuable to have fewer workers, to have shorter term returns. And that is crucial to understanding the transformation in the corporation.
And that is Lewis Hyman. He's associate professor in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. We're talking about his new book called Temp. And speaking of unions, here's Woody Guthrie's You Gotta Go Down and Join the Union. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back.
You've got to join that one big union. You've got to join it by yourself. Everybody here will join in with you. You've got to join the one big union by yourself. If the road gets rough and rocky, if the hills get steep and high.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Lewis Hyman, joining us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. He's an associate professor in the School of Industrial Labor Relations at Cornell University. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times as we approach Labor Day on Monday, author of a new book called Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if you work in this so-called gig economy. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, we've been marching through some of this history, Lewis Hyman, here, but when do you see the rise of what we call now the gig economy?
Yeah, it's a great question because when we talk about the gig economy, we see images of Uber drivers and freelancers with laptops and cafes. And it's very easy to think about this as being caused by the apps, being caused by the technology. And when something is caused by technology, it seems almost inevitable. But if you actually think about, you know, what's going on there, you realize that Uber is the waste product of the service economy, as I write in the book.
Yes, you do several times, I have to say, in the book. Yes.
I was a little taken with that phrase.
Yes,
I apologize. and I think that the reason is because it's easy to think of it as separate from the rest of the economy. But the alternative for Uber drivers and other people in this freelance world is often not that stable union job or that solid, you know, white collar office job, but, you know, slinging coffee at a Starbucks or working retail at Walmart. And the alternative there is a world of that's already insecure. Right. And so we often blame this gig economy for making our lives insecure, but that's already happened. And so when we think about the gig economy, we can say, okay, well, there's a digital-based gig economy that arises in the 2000s. You know, you can look at, you know, first Craigslist and then Elance and Odesk and then eventually Uber. But it also has to be pegged into this longer history, this history of what I call temp workers, that's about other kinds of insecure work that makes that gig labor necessary, the dissolution of that older stable job.
Well, it seems that if you look at the, again, so-called gig economy, there's probably a top and a bottom. And by that, I mean there are probably some people for which this is a perfect choice. I mean, it allows temporary work. Some people get actually paid rather well for that temporary work. They may not get the benefits, but they get some of this flexibility, some of this autonomy. But then, as you describe it, at the bottom of the heap, you get a job that doesn't pay that well. You don't get benefits. You don't have a lot of control over your time. So there's a vast difference between the top and the bottom.
I mean, it's just like the rest of work in our society, right?
Right.
Where some people at the top are doing great and some people at the bottom are doing terribly. And it doesn't really matter whether you're a 1099 or a W-2 worker. There's still inequality within our society. And, you know, I think the trick is to figure out, you know, what is the same and what's different about people in this gig economy. So if you're a high-flying consultant and you are paid, you know, six figures and you have a lot of choice over your time and people respect your opinion, you feel powerful, that's great. And, you know, that kind of flexibility is wonderful. We all want to have flexibility and control over our time and our work process. But for those at the bottom, it's not so great. And so we need to sort of, what I argue in the book is that we need to think about how to create security for those at the bottom of the gig economy as well.
Well, in fact, we've done shows or interviews on this show about low-wage workers. In many ways, besides low wages, they often don't have control over their hours. And that can be at the mercy of a scheduler who gives them 12 hours one week and 21 hours the next week. And that sort of sense that you're just buffeted by the whims of someone that you've never met before.
Or even just a computer program. So
right, there's that.
We talk a lot about income inequality in this country. We talk much less about income volatility. And income volatility is almost more pressing because, you know, for lots of people, I mean, there was a study done a few years ago by J.P. Morgan that about half of average households have month-to-month fluctuations of their income of about 30% a month. So up and down 30%, which is almost inconceivable.
That's a lot.
Imagine if you're a salaried worker. I imagine you're a salaried worker. You know, it's hard to conceive of paying that steady mortgage, steady car payment, you know, kids' braces, all the other stuff, and, you know, making that work. And this is the reality for a lot of working people that are in shift work and can't get all the hours they want from week to week. And it's certainly the case. It's absolutely the case that the gig economy has enabled those people to just work a few more hours a week and make ends meet as opposed to borrow money on their credit cards or something like that.
You coin a phrase here, permatemp. These are the temporary jobs that essentially stay temporary but never become permanent.
Yeah. It goes from being – this is the big shift, right, that Elmer Winter imagined and dreamt of but never quite realized until the 1970s. The idea that there would be a whole cadre of people who were just temporary workers that weren't ever really part of the firm, that would work side by side with your regular workers but not quite really be part of them. And we see this everywhere in our economy today, from manufacturing to office work to high technology. And certainly in Silicon Valley, the classic example is the contract programmer who wears a different color badge. So you can visibly see them as not really part of the team. And there's all kinds of ways they're excluded.
Well, are companies just saying, hey, this is cheaper. I'm going to hire someone. I don't have to cover their benefits. I don't have to provide coverage while they're on vacation. Is that the perspective of a lot of companies, which is to say, I'm going to save money by having temp workers?
Well, it's interesting because it starts in the 1970s and 80s as a way to avoid bad headlines. You know, instead of laying off 10,000 workers, you just lay off 10,000 temps, which doesn't get a headline. And so it starts off as, you know, like, wow, we're protecting our, quote, real workers. But of course, they're cheaper. They're more flexible. You know, you can hire and fire them at will, and there's no consequences. And so it becomes a way for firms to grow or contract and also seem, you know, much more valuable in the market because they don't have the headcount, which is such a warning signal for investors. And so this is definitely part of it.
Well, let me get back to the investors. And investors, they want their money and they want it now. How much has the kind of short-term view that's so associated with the stock market now, how has that affected the work economy?
I mean, it's changed everything. Everything from managers that really focus on getting their, you know, being paid in options and getting this, as we talked a lot in the last few months about stock buybacks, fueling the way in which executives are paid, but also distorting the value of, you know, how money is spent. So we go from an economy in the post-war that really focuses on long-term investment and reinvestment in a firm to a world where we are just, you know, throwing that money back into the market and hoping it lands in the right place. And, you know, oftentimes it doesn't. Oftentimes that money can be more profitably invested in consumer debt and other things. So, you know, I think that in the post-war, the 1% paid the 99% wages. And after 1970, they just lent them money. And this is the sort of central tension within our economy that money is accumulating at the top, but it's not being invested in a way that produces good jobs for people at the bottom. And that's sort of the virtuous cycle of capitalism that's been broken.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lewis Hyman. He is an associate professor in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. And we've been talking about his new book. It's called Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And if this sounds like you, we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Kate had a question. Can your guests address the idea of guaranteed income? And you do at the end of the book have some ideas about how to address some of the insecurities that so many people feel today.
Sure. The basic income is this idea that's very popular right now, especially among those who think that machines are going to come and take all our jobs. And the idea has a long history going back a few centuries, the idea that there are people who are valueless within our economy. And the idea is to create a floor that enables, you know, all the other jobs to be above that. And it's a very popular idea. It's a very popular among libertarians. It's a very popular idea on the left. And I think what's important about it is whether or not you think that's a viable idea. You know, certainly there are people who think it's a wonderful idea that it could enable us to be liberated, to become entrepreneurs, to become artists, to become whatever people want to do and not fear starvation or homelessness. But on the other hand, there's those who fear that it will lead to purposelessness. People will just hand over their monthly checks and live in, poverty-ridden areas, right? So there's a lot of and just drift and watch TV all the time. So I think what's important here about the basic income is not whether or not it's a viable policy. What's important is that we as a society, both on the left and the right, have a conversation about the world that is emerging, a world of flexible labor, and certainly AI and other kinds of technology will be part of that. But the real transformation is the death of the relationship between employer and employee that we haven't fully addressed. I think both on the left and right, we are nostalgic for this post-war. We're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. And instead, I think we need to address the reality of the world as it is. So in the book, I lay out both conservative and progressive approaches, because I think regardless of your politics, it's important to realize that the world is changing.
Well, you talk about something called citizen share. What is that?
So in the book, my favorite version of
I could
the
tell.
Basic. Yeah, I think this is the one I like best, which is instead of having just a version of the earned income tax credit or some kind of monthly payment, because I think that sounds too much like welfare, which people on the right are not particularly interested in. And I also think it hides the essential truth that we are all part of this system. So corporations are possible, you know, famously often said that they socialize risk and privatize return. And in the long history of the corporation, at the beginning, you could only have corporations when they were monopolies for the public good, you know, bridges and grist mills and things like that. And today we've sort of lost track of that. We give them protections and we don't get much in return. And so in the book, I talk about this idea of the citizen share, where instead of thinking of this as, you know, welfare benefits, we think of it as universal. We think of it as ownership, that there is some fraction of each stock share that we have a right to as citizens. And so in the book, I talk about a holding company where we each get a share, and this is really wonkish. We each get a share, and
We can be wonkish.
Okay, I guess so. And as corporations make profits, obviously it goes back to private stockholders, but also to the public. And so, as people lose their jobs to technology, as some corporations succeed, well, we all get a cut of that. And I don't know exactly where that cut should be, but what I like about this is it makes it seem less like a handout and more like a collective enterprise, that we are all in this together and we all want to succeed. And I like the idea that as people are replaced by machines, instead of just being tossed to the street, they get a cut of that money. And as a society, we all benefit.
That got me also thinking about what appears to be the appeal of so-called or democratic socialism, or a number of democratic candidates who are winning, who either call themselves a democratic socialist or find those ideas appealing. There seems to be something afoot here, and I wonder whether it is a reflection about this kind of anxiety that we've been talking about.
I think that it is. I mean, despite the numbers on the unemployment, right, we see that we're told that there are jobs for everybody. Well, about 6 to 8% of people have just dropped out of the workforce entirely since 2008. And you know, this is what you see in the labor force participation rate, which is not as well covered in the media. And it is a stunning divergence between those who are high in demand, college graduates with advanced degrees, and those who are not that. Most Americans do not have a college degree. And it's very easy to be in the bubble and think that everyone does. But for those people who are outside of it, man, you are in a very different world. And in the kinds of work, you may have a job, but that job doesn't provide stability or security or growth. And it certainly doesn't look like the job of 1955 for working people. So I think that's where there's a new openness to thinking about, well, how do we make capitalism work for us, not just work us over? And that is a hard question to answer.
Well, and it's also this notion of Medicare for all or decoupling health insurance from employment, which, of course, has been there for generations now. How do you see that?
I think that would be great. I would love for young people who want to strike out on their own and try and start a new business and grow the economy have access to health care, which is part of this foundation for taking risks, and of course, access to capital. So right now, there's about $2.5 trillion in excess money in our banking system. Wow. That's just sitting there idle. How nice would it be if you could get access to that for your business, as opposed to just, you know, borrowing on your credit card? And I think if you're serious about an entrepreneurship society, you have to realize that it's very easy for rich people to become entrepreneurs or their children because they already have this buffer of security. And we need to create that for lots of smart people who aren't born into the best of circumstances. And so if we're serious about an equal opportunity society, this is what it looks like. It looks like a place where you can take risks and still, you know, get your leg fixed if you break your leg.
What's this $2.5 trillion you refer to?
In the Federal Reserve System, there is money that is required for banks to hold in reserve so that if they're, you know, they need, or there's a run on the bank or whatever. On top of that, you can see it in the data, the publicly available data, that there's $2.5 trillion just sitting there in the banks that is uninvested. And so part of how we think about capitalism working is that we say, okay, it's okay for some people to get richer. They make more money, but that money then gets saved and it gets reinvested in businesses, which create jobs. And that's certainly not the case today. We see wild speculation in assets, housing, and the like. We see investment in consumer debt, and we don't see the availability of this capital going back to small businesses, to Etsy micro entrepreneurs or even just local plumbers. And that system is broken and we need to fix it as well.
Almost up on our second break here. Are there enough jobs, though, to go around?
Well, I mean, it's a question of, you know, why are there not jobs? So that's not just a zero-sum thing. The amazing thing about capitalism and its history is that it's an economy of growth and it's an economy of inequality. And it is a dynamically creating force. So, yeah, jobs are destroyed. You know, the last Blockbuster is now in Bend, Oregon, right? And so, you know, at its peak, you know, 10 years ago, Blockbuster employed about 80,000 people. I think that's more than there are coal miners in the U.S. right now. And, you know, it's destroyed a lot. But then now there's a lot of professional podcasters and jobs are being created. And I think that Americans are incredibly talented and innovative people, and we need to support them in that. So 500,000 people work full-time selling things on Etsy. And Etsy didn't exist 10 years ago either. So it's a trade-off.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. This is Huey Lewis in the news, working for a living.
Sunday morning ever, and Sunday's passing by. I'll be working here forever, at least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know damn well I won't.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Lewis Hyman about his new book. It's called Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And he teaches at Cornell University. And he writes in this book that Uber, an example of the gig economy or temporary work, is the waste product of the service economy. We'd like to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if you work in this kind of economy. And of course, there are many kinds of jobs, including adjuncts and part-timers and consultants and day laborers, freelancers, contractors, and more. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We want to hear your story, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We began, Lewis, talking in the 1950s about that economy and how in many ways it benefited the full-time worker who happened to be largely white and male. But now, of course, we've got people of color in the workforce. We've got women in the workforce. We've got immigrants, legal and undocumented in the workforce. How has that changed the work environment?
Well, I think that the society we live in right now still doesn't value women as much as men, doesn't value people of color as much as white people. And you can see the inequities in their pay in many different segments. And certainly it doesn't value people who are non-citizens as much as citizens. And this matters for people who aren't even in those categories. It matters for men and white people and Americans, because people who are left out of that security then become an alternative, even if you don't think that all people matter equally, which, of course, I do. I think that you should realize that by protecting other people, you're protecting yourself, that people on the margins define what's possible in the center. So temp workers are still not the majority of workers in this economy, but they define the limits of what's possible, and they define alternatives for employers. And so that threat, what Elmer Winchard called a market yardstick, is in our everyday workplaces these days.
I'm thinking about pensions and those, of course, the pensions that is always forget whether it's employer defined or employee. Anyway, the kind of pensions that were guaranteed back in the 50s that seemed to be going the way of the dinosaur replaced by the 401k. Does that tell us, is that an example of what we're talking about here?
Sure. In the book, I think that that's sort of a very conservative model for how we could adapt to this economy. So just as we move from defined pensions, we could move to the 401k. We could sort of think about our healthcare and other kinds of social security as tied to just moving from job to job, just like we do with the 401k, only with less paperwork.
I'm thinking about robots and the factory floor. I mean, it seems, and you had an interesting piece in the New York Times headlined, it's not technology that's disrupting our jobs. But I think in many ways, you look at a factory floor and you see these giant robots and you do see people. It does look like the robots are replacing the people.
I mean, certainly in some industries, there are highly mechanized production facilities, you know, beer. Nobody has to make beer anymore in America. I think that's a great argument for nationalization. If you look at lots of workplaces, there is this idea of robots building robots, but it also does a kind of cultural work, right? So, you know, when the first Macintosh plant was built in 1984, it was touted as machines building machines. But in Silicon Valley then and now, every time someone says robot, usually what's actually doing the work is not a machine but a person, and that person is a woman of color. And you can see it in the language today around Uber and self-driving cars, that there is some sort of imagined, autonomous, machine-driven future. And, you know, that legitimates a very unequal present. So it's this future that never quite arrives, but the reality of the now is already here.
But don't you think the future is a machine-driven one?
I mean, I think that machines are incredibly important. You know, the fact that you and I are not going out in the next few weeks to bring in the harvest, as the majority of Americans would have done in 1850, is a wonderful thing. And the mechanical thresher is the closest thing to AI that we're going to see. So the question is about machines is not, you know, they're not inevitable. They can liberate us. They can make us immiserate us. It's the question of productivity, which is what machines fundamentally are, is a political question rather than just an economic question. Who gets the benefit of that productivity? Who gets the returns on those machines? And this has been a central tension in the history of capitalism since the Industrial Revolution.
Because decisions are made, choices are made. This is how we're going to do things.
Yeah, it's a contest of power between, you know, workers and employers and investors and the state. And it's a question of, you know, fairness and who gets to decide what is the fair and equitable distribution of those profits and what kind of society do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a society where very few people get all the money, or do you live in a society where it's more evenly distributed?
Is that an argument for bringing back unions or empowering unions?
I mean, I think unions have to empower themselves. So it's not simply enough to pass a law and have hope that it'll all turn out well. And that's not what happened in the 30s and 40s, despite the narratives were taught about the New Deal. What actually happened was that workers in the middle of the Great Depression formed new kinds of industrial unions, the CIO, to organize unskilled workers who had never been organized in that way before. And they did successfully. And they went to the biggest corporation in the world, the General Motors Corporation, and they organized themselves. Mm-hmm. And today, we need to think about, you know, what that looks like. And maybe it's part of the AFL-CIO. Maybe it's not. But workers need a voice in this economy. And it may or may not look like unions in the past. And mm-hmm. I think that's also an important lesson from Uber. Uber didn't follow the law. Uber broke the law. Every single market it moved into, it broke the law. And yet it's successful, and it's successful because of its power, because of its economic power. And I think there's a lot that the labor movement can learn from Uber in thinking about how to organize in a distributed supply chain economy doesn't look the same as a manufacturing economy.
But you've got people who are dispersed, who in a sense, work for themselves. How do you organize people that don't even know the other person exists?
I think a lot about, I'm a historian, and I think a lot about 1877, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, which the similar argument was made. How do you organize workers across a railroad, across distances of time and space that it was hard to conceive? And the answer was this new kind of technology called the telegraph. Exactly the same technology that was used to organize the trains, working Americans used to organize themselves. And the very first national strike occurred through that. So today, as we think about the future, we should think about the past and how technology that's used to control and organize us, like algorithmic management of our schedules or different kinds of, you know, digital labor platforms, we should think about how to organize ourselves through those technologies as well. And you see this in platform cooperativism. You see this in various kinds of communities that are forming, like Turker Nation, that are trying to push back in new ways against this world. It takes time, though. It takes time, sure. And it takes imagination.
We got a lot of people that want to join us. Let me get David from Maple Glen to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
Marty. Terrific show.
Thank you.
I'm glad we're talking about unions here when I come in on my call, because I think one of the important things to mention is that unions are so weak in the U.S. now because the percentage of unions is down, I think, to 9% in the private sector. And, you know, more in the public sector. But there's a big attack on now on public sector unions that is based on creating resentment by other workers who don't have the same level of benefits, you know, real pensions that hardly anyone has anymore, et cetera. And the point I would make is, just as the speaker mentioned, that the outliers in employment create the conditions that everybody ends up having to work with, the outlier on the other side is unions, and workers in general of all types need to value and not resent the benefits that the public sector workers have won, because that's setting the standard to which they should all aspire in demanding better conditions, from better pay, better benefits from their employers. So we should be defending the public sector unions, not resenting them.
David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lewis, I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're living in this age of the politics of resentment. So if you have it, it means I don't have it. Mm-hmm. And certainly public sector unions emerged in the 1960s, you know, long after private sector unions had succeeded. And actually, the numbers are lower. I think it's about 6% for the rate of private sector unionization these days. But I think that this is true, right, that we feel resentful towards those who have that kind of security. And you see it all kinds of ways. You see it generationally, so that people under 34, about half of them participate in the freelance economy. And you see it between those who are in the private sector trying to scrape together multiple jobs. And they see these government jobs as the last refuge of security and are frustrated that they have to pay for it when they don't get it in their own lives. So I think for me anyway, the answer is not get rid of that kind of security if for government workers, but think about how we can restore it to the rest of us. And hopefully that will dim this kind of rage. But until we do that, it's not going to.
David, thanks for the call. A question from John. He says, what about the underground economy? All those carpenters, electricians, food service workers, laborers, et cetera, who get paid under the table. How do we factor them in?
I mean, I think they're probably a large fraction of that 6 to 8% that is no longer looking for work, that dropped out of the economy. We have the drug trade. We have carpenters. We have undocumented workers. I think a large part of the book, I know because I wrote the book, a large part of the book is about undocumented workers and people who are working outside of the law, whether that law is labor law or tax law or environmental law. And this population is crucial to understanding the growth of the construction industry, you know, and the electronics industry. These are the two big growth engines, if you want to look at things that are still made in America. Then they're led by hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of undocumented workers who work in conditions that are dangerous and low paid and full of insecurity. And it's important, as we think about this, that we understand that part of the remaking of the corporation, the legal economy from top to bottom, from consultants to the undocumented migrants, is contingent upon this space of people who are left out, who are hidden for various reasons.
Mike says, as the drive to the bottom continues and creates more and more low-income workers, who will have the money to buy the stuff that the drivers of the race are making? Is this a potential threat to the sustainability of the economy? And he's just talking about this divide, which I think your book in part is another way to talk about this divide in the country.
That divide's already here. This is why we see luxury brands touted of everywhere for things that I can't afford, and I don't know who can afford those things. And at the same time, we have most of us are shopping at Walmart, right, or Amazon or other kinds of cheaper places. And we already live in that economy. And, you know, the GDP continues to grow. It just doesn't grow for most of us. And so I think the discussion we want to have is like, well, you know, the economy grew really well in the post-war, and it also created good jobs. And there's a lot of things that are left out of that conversation from the post-war. You know, one, if you want to talk about manufacturing and cheap goods, well, that thing you see on your label, the manufacturer's suggested retail price, that used to mean something. Hmm. And there were floors for how things could be sold. And it enabled those factory owners to pay their workers a living wage, a good wage, and follow the rules. And we got rid of that. And we said, well, we'd rather have cheap stuff. And we see the consequences of that in all over us, our lives today.
Which raises a question. I wonder, the way we measure our economy or GDP, are we using the right metrics?
Yeah, this is a big question because, you know, think about all the free stuff you use on your phone or over the internet and you don't pay for, at least not directly. Does that count? As opposed to, you know, of course, Google and Facebook are making money off advertising revenue. But this question of, you know, how are we measuring the economy? Should we be measuring it in this traditional way, and what's being left out of that measurement? It's a very controversial issue. But what we do know is that GDP is not a very good number if you really want to mean the well-being of the American people. Just as unemployment isn't a particularly good measure if you want to understand, do people have the jobs they want, or are they underemployed? So there's a lot of other measurements. We try to simplify things, and we really miss a lot of the story in doing so.
Almost out of time here, and I don't know if this is a fair question. Can you measure happiness and make that part of a GDP?
People are trying to do that. It seems pretty hard to me to measure happiness. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's an age old question. I'd rather start with, do you have enough to eat? Can you pay your bills on time before we get to more abstract philosophical concerns?
Well, we are going to end on that note. Lewis Hyman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
A real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And his new book is titled Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And he is an associate professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. And he joined us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And we wanted him to join us as we approach the Labor Day weekend. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Mike Villers and Diana Martinez, the engineers for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the